freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Matthew Nugent.
And I'm Jason Marocek.
Thanks for joining us for today, everybody. Our goal is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our republic. We want to engage members of our armed forces, veterans, first responders, and the patriots who support them in their noble professions. Folks, we have a new email address. It's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. If you have any questions or comments or something you'd like us to cover, please send us a line. Okay, y'all ready?
Yes, I am.
Let's do this. Okay, title of today's episode is We Defeated the Tyrant, Now What? Okay, so let's paint a picture. At the end of the American War of Independence, we were free, but the new government was struggling. We needed a new form of government. We needed to protect our unalienable rights, that's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And using these timeless principles, folks, which we use to create our form of government now, they apply today. So note, please pay attention to how this applies today. Now, the reason why America was struggling at the time is because the form of government, which was the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation is basically the Constitution 1.0, okay? Because before our Constitution today, which is Constitution 2.0, there was the Articles of Confederation, Constitution 1.0. Now, because to describe what the Articles of Confederation are, you got to understand that these 13 different colonies, we call them states, were almost like 13 independent countries. And the Articles of Confederation can be described more like a treaty between countries than a constitution like we have today. So with that, there were a lot of problems. Now, the Articles of Confederation were drafted during the War of Independence, okay? Back in 77, it was drafted, but it was ratified by all states in 1781. So imagine, war started in 1776, and this was ratified in 1781. So we were 5 years without a country. It was basically 13 independent countries, okay, yeah, without a form of central government.
Yeah, and that's really only the first of the problems that we face because of the kind of the weak the weak document that was the Articles of Confederation. So you mentioned the first one, right? We were basically, it took too long to ratify it, and so we were without a form of government. And you know, the central government was very weak under the Articles, right? There was no executive branch. It was basically all the Continental Congress. So there was no one to execute the laws nationally. And there wasn't really a federal or a national judicial branch. So all of that was left up to the states. So again, back to your point about it being basically 13 different countries, all with their own judicial systems. Mm-hmm. And then the culmination of the weakness of that document, of this, the failure of them to have a strong central government, a strong executive branch, was the Shays Rebellion. Now, you know, I don't remember learning about Shays Rebellion from when I was in school. So obviously I had to go back and look at it. We're not going to get into the details other than the fact that there was a rebellion in Western Massachusetts in 1786. Right. And so this is, you know, 3 years after the War of Independence. After the end of the War of Independence. So it's an uprising in Western Massachusetts. Well, something like that, you would expect that a national executive branch would come down and enforce the laws against that rebellion. Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't do it because they didn't have a strong executive branch. So what happened is they had to rely on the state militia in Massachusetts to do that. So this was one of the highlights. So there's several other weaknesses. You know, one, they only had one house of their Congress, right? It was a unicameral legislature. So basically you had one state, one vote. So states could essentially dictate the terms, right? As a state, they could either hold back their approval for something, or they can give it for something. And the people weren't necessarily represented, you know, individually and in their locations, right? So it was just one state, one vote. They also had, you know, there were some of the laws that were cited in the Articles of Confederation. It required basically a supermajority of the states to pass. And so again, you had these states or almost many countries that were able
Jason, what's a supermajority?
Yeah, no, good question. So supermajority means not only do you have to get 50% of the votes plus one vote, but in the Articles of Confederation, you had to have 9 states in some cases give their assent
three fourths.
In this case, three fourths was the supermajority. So you know, a handful of states could stop something good from happening to the country in terms of making laws. So that was a problem. The only way you could amend it, so the only way they could fix this was, again, with a unanimous vote. So you could have one state that held out in order to get what they wanted, right? And, of course, they didn't have the ability to enforce tax collection. This was one of the major, you know, aside from the lack of a strong central executive branch, this was one of the other major influencers. And they couldn't enforce their tax collection. All they could do is request. They made requisitions. The Continental Congress says, hey, states, we really need to fund, we need to buy some more weapons for our militias or more cannons for our naval vessels. Connecticut, would you please send us $50,000? Massachusetts, please send us $75,000. Yeah. And then those states would go back and say, can we afford it? No, we can't. Sorry, national government, no cannons this fiscal year. And so the problem was is that they couldn't actually enforce this tax collection. And so that was a huge issue. And it was causing a lot of problems. One of the more urgent needs at that point was the fact that they had just got done fighting this war. They'd taken loans, and they've gotten loans from other countries in order to fight the war from major lenders. They couldn't pay back those loans because they couldn't enforce the tax collection to get the money. States really could form treaties with other countries. So you might
have... Which is very problematic.
Yes,
because
extremely.
You could literally have half of the states or, you know, there are odd numbers, so you can't really have half. But imagine if they made a treaty with France and other half of the countries didn't. It could be new France. So it was so problematic.
Yeah, it definitely was, lent them open to influence from other countries, but even more so, or another extremely bad problem that this caused was you could have foreign countries pitting states against each other for trade.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
They could give preferred terms to one state and not the other, and which caused rivalries within the country. So very problematic. They also had all the states had their own currencies. So imagine crossing state lines and saying, we're not going to take your money. They did have a national currency as well, but it wasn't worth it. I think there was a phrase that says, it's not worth a continental. It was the phrase back then because it was depreciation had just, you know, blown it out of the water. So what was the solution? All these things came to a head in Shays' Rebellion, and a lot of the leaders, the founders back then said, or the framers rather at that point, they said, you know what? We got to fix this. So they decided to meet in Annapolis in 1786 to try to talk about how they could enlarge the Articles of Confederation so they could fix it and make it more powerful. Problem was in Annapolis, not enough of the delegates showed up. So they didn't really have a quorum. They didn't have enough states where they felt comfortable representing the entire nation. And so they decided, you know what, we're going to go ahead and adjourn, and we're going to agree to meet in Philadelphia next May of 1787 to fix these problems. And if you are a student of history, you know that that's when the Continental Congress convened in May of 1787. Mm-hmm. So, this is where all those delegates and then some from all the states came together. And they mutually recognize that, you know what, just fixing what we have in the Articles of Confederation isn't going to solve our problem. We actually need to start from scratch. And so that was a huge revelation. And at that time, okay, so now they wipe the board clean and they say, we're going to start from scratch. What are we going to do? What kind of nation are we going to create? What is the form of government? And they set forth these, you know, guiding principles is what we'll call them today, right? There's three of them, and we'll talk about these in depth, and we'll mention them again. The first one is we have to ensure that we understand the proper role of government, and that is the only role of government is to protect our unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They had just written the document, 11 years ago?
Yeah,
11 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So they said that is the proper role of government. We have to abide by that. The second guiding principle was we have to make this a republican form of government. And we're going to get into why that is here in a second. But that was the second one. It has to be a republican form of government. And the third one was it has to have checks and balances so that no one entity or no one branch could be more powerful than another. And in case you are, you know, we're not going to get into the debates of the Constitutional Convention, but if you are interested, there is a document that's called the Records of the Federal Convention of 1787 that was edited and compiled by a man named Max Farrand that goes through and gives from different perspectives all of the debates and votes inside the Constitutional Convention, which, by the way, at the time was secret. They weren't allowed to divulge anything that happened in the convention to the public. But now we have the notes of, you know, the records of the convention. We have Madison's notes. We have two other sets of notes that we can compile and look at. So,
yeah. So if you if you ever wanted to look inside what was going on, the record of the Federal Convention of 1787 is great. We'll also talk about the Federalist Papers, which have to do with that, we'll talk about here. But if you mm-hmm. really want to get in there, what an amazing thing to do if you really want to dig in.
Yeah. And so we'll have that. You of course, can look it up, but we will also have it. I believe it's on our Freedom Library on our website at patriotcoalitionlive.com. But we will also have it in the show notes for episode 15. This one here, we'll put a link to it there as well. So all of these discussions in the convention, in the Constitutional Convention, were about how to institute a republican form of government. And the first one, the first consideration they made, as I pointed out, was the form of government. That is, you know, they just fought mm-hmm. the most powerful country in the world mm-hmm. to avoid the tyranny of a monarchy. So they mm-hmm. certainly weren't going to be a monarchy. And so the next best thing in their minds was some sort of representative form of government. Well, you have democracy, you know, like you had, let's say, in Greece, you know, Athens, and you have a republic. And the difference is pretty profound, but it's lost on today's media and many of the elected officials today. So what is the difference between a republic and a democracy, and why would they choose one instead of the other? Well, a republic, and I'm going to cite the definition from Webster's 1828 dictionary.
Not modern dictionary, yes. Because a modern dictionary is more like a chalkboard. Webster's dictionary.com or dictionary.com, it changes literally in a few minutes depending on who's in power and what they dictate what it is. So go back and use an old version of the dictionary.
Yeah. And I would go one step further, not just people in power. Sometimes I just read last year where, you know, based on all the upheaval that's going on through the country, a person wrote in and said, hey, I wish I remembered the name or what the word was, but they said, hey, I don't think this word means what it used to mean anymore. Let's make it this now. And one of the major dictionaries said, okay, we're going to change it. So social upheaval, social pressure can also cause this chalkboard that Matt refers to, which is a great analogy.
It's not a dictionary. It's a chalkboard. Dictionary, you know, that you can rely upon, but anything digital, it can be changed.
Yep. So I use Webster's 1828 dictionary. I think it's at Webster's Dictionary 1828.com. But again, we'll post that link on our show notes. Okay. So the definition of a republic: a state in which the exercise of the sovereign power is lodged in representatives elected by the people. A state in which the exercise of the sovereign power, meaning the legislative power, is lodged in representatives elected by the people, okay? Now, compare that with a democracy, which is a form of government in which the supreme power is lodged in the hands of the people collectively. So the difference there is, who wields the legislative power? In a republic, it's our representatives. But in a democracy, all the people get to make the law, literally make the laws. They make the laws and they vote on the laws themselves.
That would be chaos. That would be chaos.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So James Madison, who was the fourth president of the United States, has a great quote about democracies. This is a Federalist number 10.
Oh, yeah.
And a little bit of background on the Federalist Papers, which were written starting in about 1787. Okay, there are about 85 of them written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. And he says, democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. So a true democracy is chaos, ends in violence.
Yeah.
So
it's mob rule. And, the founders and the framers, they were very, they're students of history. They knew what happened in Greece and Athens. One of the other founders, Benjamin Franklin, he said it even more succinctly. He said, and this is probably a more famous quote. It says, democracy is essentially two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner.
There we go.
Obviously, the wolves are going to win, and the sheep is as SOL, as we say.
So if we were to draw a picture, okay, so, you know, you got two sides of the spectrum. Let's say one on the left is a full democracy, mob rule, okay? And on the right, you've got a monarchy, which is 100% tyranny. So what our founders wanted was they wanted the sovereignty to be in the people's hand, but they wanted something to offset the fickle passions of human beings, because based on what we read, based on what information we're getting, our emotions and our opinions can change on a dime. So kind of a pause for that, you know, like when you hit a bump in the road, you have shocks. The shock absorbers are elected officials. Okay. Plus, you can't expect everybody to, you know, answer yes or no to a vote, you know, every day for all that we've got to do. It just makes sense. It's efficient. So
I want to highlight that point you made, especially the analogy. It's a great analogy of a shock absorber. You may have, you know, if Trader Joe Biden, Trader Joe, tomorrow says, you know what?
Trader in chief. Yeah.
Trader in chief. If he makes a law tomorrow that says, you know what? No, citizen is allowed to have a weapon. Poor example. If he says, I want everybody who is a redhead to be executed, right? All the redheads are going to be up in arms, and they're going to be clamoring for their rights. And if the media does their job, and the media is casting all redheads as, hey, they are those redheads, they're mutants, they foment violence, they are it's inciting rebellion, and we ought to put them to death. And the majority of people are saying, yes, death to the redheads. If the people had the right to vote, all of us redheads would be put to death, right? But as they hit the speed bump and a speed bump of elected representatives, now those representatives can say, wait a minute, don't we have that thing called the Constitution? And it says that no person should be deprived of life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness without due process of law, maybe it's not a great idea that we go against the Constitution. So the elected representatives, to Matt's point, act as a speed bump and remove themselves from the passion of the mob. So great example.
Yeah. So if you take Jason's example, and by the way, he's a redhead and I like him, so I would vote against that. Not to mention the Constitution. Okay. So keep that in mind. But Jason's analogy is so realistic and relevant today, because right now, if you listen to the leftist rhetoric, for example, MSNBC, anyone who is or was a Trump supporter is characterized as they're being conflated in with terrorists, those who attacked Congress on, you know, earlier this year. So their goal is to shut up anyone who doesn't align with leftist and socialist ideology. Be very clear. And because the traitor in chief, also called Traitor Joe, not to be confused with Trader Joe's, the store, they've got, the leftists have the executive branch, both the House and the Senate. So they have a lot of power. And, you know, and the Supreme Court right now is leaning conservative, more constitutional. So it is very possible with the power that the Dems have and the liberal left has and socialists, they're almost synonymous, or at least the majority voice, you know, the loud voice. So they are pushing tyranny upon us, using the media as a weapon to characterize people who love freedom and love liberty as terrorists. Yeah. Now, it is really easy to get caught up in this, and it's an example of how, hey, let's take a step back, and we have our elected officials to say, time out here. And so when you describe, so understand that's what a true democracy is in mob rule. Now, some people say this is a democracy. America is a democracy. If you were going to use democracy to describe America, it is important that you say a representative democracy, because our form of government, our form of government is a republic. Now, in terms of our election process, each individual person has a vote, but even that goes through the Electoral College. And here's why, okay?
Well, only in the presidential election, right?
Yeah, but only in the presidential election. So in the context of we're a democracy, we're a representative democracy in terms of government, but it's more accurate to describe us as a republic, if that is what we are.
Yeah, now, the democracy really only describes, as it applies to the United States, only in the way that we vote, because everybody, you know, has equal suffrage, right? That's the limit of the influence of democracy on our republic. Yeah, not in the way that we make our laws, which is invested in another, in our representatives.
There we go. So when you think about that, the election process, the left is trying to take away the Electoral College. Now, what that would do what would mean is about just a handful of cities in the United States would influence the entire election. Because, for example, San Francisco and L.A., that would be all of California. You know, New York, for example, Atlanta, and that would cover enough to take those states, which would tip it so that the left. Typically, because they tend to be Democratic, or, you know, it might be Republican someday. Okay. And if you're a constitutional minded person, you want what's right for people in terms of representation, no matter which party you're on. Okay.
Right. Same set of rules for everybody.
Yes. So equality under the law. So understand that if that we're taking away the Electoral College process, the most powerful position in the United States and in the world really would be up to the whims and the fickle passions of really just a handful of cities, which is not representative government.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
If one third of the three, my parts of our government, you know, one third being the executive branch, were, you know, subject to those whims without a speed bump, then that would be very, very problematic. So,
and not to mention the fact that the rest of the country would go, you know, would go without any sort of ability to influence who is executing the laws that their representatives are making. So, it's if you don't have influence on both of those, then what good is making laws if they're not going to be executed the way that they're supposed to be?
There we go. And so that's why we have these checks and balances.
So speaking of which, so the checks and balances, we just talked about whether or not the founders and the framers put together a republic versus democracy. The next thing that they were worried about is these checks and balances, right? So when we talk about checks and balances, most of us probably remember, if nothing else, from our civics days, maybe in elementary school and maybe even high school, that the checks and balances are supposed to make things work fair, or they're supposed to make things work smoothly in our governments. The concept, though, in checks and balances, the checks are actually supposed to represent conflict between branches of government. That's why how they're checking each other is a moderated, orderly way have conflict, so that not one person can get too powerful, or not one branch of government. And the balances are really supposed to split the power between the three different branches. So when you hear checks and balances, you're really thinking, you know, conflict and separation of those powers. You know, the founders, you know, now that they've agreed that they're going to have a republic, they had to figure out how they're going to form it. And so this concept of checks and balances and in implementing the three branches of government was the way they decided to do that. So, in fact, that was one of the very first things they did in the Continental Congress, is they were separating the power into those three branches. They were adding to the, you know, when you looked at the Articles of Confederation, you only had a legislative branch, but so now they're adding the executive and the judicial to the government. They, you know, so again, so that one branch would not have all the power. So there's a couple different ways that they were going to try to separate that power. One of them is, and we referred to this in an earlier episode, one of that is, those ways that we would separate power is horizontally, meaning, if you think of, you know, judicial, executive, and legislative is all being on the same level, but horizontally, we separate them that way. The other way we separate them is vertically, you know, between the federal government or the central government and the state governments. So let's talk really briefly about the horizontal separation of power. So as we talked about, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and legislative branch, they all have their different areas of responsibility. So we'll go in order of the articles. The legislative branch first, obviously they make the laws, right? The executive branch, they are supposed to execute the laws that the legislature makes. And then the judicial branch is supposed to resolve discrepancies, or they're supposed to decide on different controversies that arise out of, wait a minute, did they do this right? Did they not do this right? So these checks, as you may have recalled, come in the form of powers that each one has over the other one. So if legislature makes a law that the executive branch says, you know what, that either that's not constitutional or I don't agree that's the right policy, he can veto it, right? But again, the legislative branch, if he vetoes it, meaning that he says, no, this is not going to be a law, they can then turn around and say, you know what, yeah, we really do think that. And if they have a 2/3 vote in both houses, they can they can actually pass a law without over his veto.
Override the veto.
Yep. It's called overriding the veto. So this is a way that those two branches have conflict or checks on each other. But even if they do pass it and somebody challenges it and it goes to the Supreme Court, they could render an opinion that says, no, this is not constitutional. So the judicial branch can have that check over the legislative branch. So what about judicial and executive? Well, if the judicial branch, and we talked about this last episode with Andrew Jackson's controversy with the Supreme Court, if the judicial branch renders an opinion that the executive branch doesn't agree with, the executive branch can just ignore him or do the opposite of what the opinion says, you know, at his own peril, right?
Yeah.
If the people believe that, hey, that's not right, they can always, you know, impeach him or whatever.
So think about that, guys. It's written in so laws can be ignored. Think about that. Not just because it's a law doesn't mean it's constitutional. And we're going to talk a little bit about more here, interposition, that we as American citizens, through our personal action, through our right to vote, and through our voice, we can stand in the gap, which is what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And more precisely, you know, a bill that passes the House and is signed by the executive or is overridden is enacted unconstitutionally, right? It's called an unconstitutional enactment. It's not even considered a law because a law is in pursuance of the Constitution. And we'll talk more about that in detail as we get to those branches of the government in later episodes. So, and then the final check that we'll talk about today is between the legislative and the judicial branch, right? So if the judicial branch says, you know what, the law that you wrote, it doesn't apply the way that you, it is not constitutional, or it overextends your authority past what is constitutional, the legislature can repeal the law or write another one that clarifies it, right? So that they have the ability to go ahead and write new laws that won't be scrutinized so much by the judicial branch. So all those things create conflict between branches horizontally to make sure that not one of those branches can exert too much power and influence over the people, okay? And in fact, there's a good back to the Federalist Papers that Matt talked about. In Federalist number 78, Alexander Hamilton said this about the judiciary. He said, "The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy," meaning the effectiveness, "of its judgments."
So what that means also, what if you've got a crazy president who says, "I'm going to do what I'm going to do"? People will vote him out of office. So there are a lot of checks there. If someone gets out of control in legislation and legislative branch, this would also apply.
Yeah. And in Hamilton's quote here, this is really highlighting the what Andrew Jackson said later on. He said, when they say the sword or the purse, the sword is intended to be the executive branch and the purse is supposed to be the legislative branch. He's saying the judiciary doesn't have control over either one of those. So they can't spend the money and they can't enforce whatever opinions they come up with. So it's just a good example. So next, let's talk about the vertical separation of powers. So that is the difference between the central government in Washington, D.C. and all the state governments. So again, Hamilton, I'm going to give another quote from that same Federalist paper, 78, where he talks about this.
This is old English, folks. Old English.
Yeah, buckle up. We're going to clarify after we talk about it. So don't fret if your head explodes in the meantime. It says, "Power being almost always the rival of power," meaning power, two powerful people or entities are always going to be fighting with each other for dominance. So power being almost always the rival of power, the general government, meaning that in D.C., will at all times stand ready to check the usurpations of the state governments. And these, meaning the state governments, will have the same disposition towards the general government. The people, by throwing themselves into either scale, if you can imagine like a set of scales, will infallibly make it preponderate. If their rights are invaded by either, meaning state or central, they can make use of the other as the instrument of redress. So if we were to rephrase this, we're saying, look, a powerful person or entity is always going to be rivaling with another power to be more powerful. And if we're, let's now put this in the terms of state and general. The state and general government are always going to be rivaling with each other for as much power as they can get. But if they overstep their bounds, the people can throw their weight into one or the other, if you can, again, imagine the scales, if you're not watching on our video, and balance them out by giving their weight to either the state or the general government if they're becoming too powerful or if they're being overwhelmed by the other. So we have that ability and that right and duty to make sure that the right entity is exerting the right amount of power. Matt, another way to say that?
If you're, I like to use a boxing analogy, your left jab, you hook with the right. So Article 1, Section 8, which is the enumerated powers of Congress. Remember, Article 1 is about legislation process. Article 2 is about the executive. Article 3 in the Constitution is about the judicial branch. But Article 1, Section 8 talks about the enumerated powers of Congress. That's kind of like your jab. Now, the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Bam, right hook. So what this means is, for example, the Second Amendment gives citizens the right to bear arms. If the government comes down and infringes upon those rights in the form of a presidential edict, which with the traitor in chief there, he's going to try to do that. Or someone in Congress starts to legislate our arms or semi-automatic weapons away from us. You can say, hey, Congress, Article 1, Section 8 says you can't. And let's see, President, 10th Amendment says this is the purvey of the state. Okay, so the question is, what do I do? So you guys listen to this, what can I do? Okay.
Well, and sorry to interrupt, but so in the example you're using, obviously the Second Amendment is going to, prevail over both of those. But obviously Matt's point is that regardless of what the edict or the legislation that comes down is, we can cite either, hey, first Article 1, Section 8 doesn't give Congress the authority to do that. Or it says, look, state government has control over this because it's not listed there. So we can very clearly define what is in both buckets, who has the authority, and then we'll throw our weight behind the other one that is infringing on that tyranny or on that liberty.
That's right. And in fact, different states might even infringe on your liberties as well.
Right.
In California, they've got some really strange gun laws. I don't agree with a lot of those laws. The ones that I'm familiar with, they don't make sense other than to make the citizen weaker. Okay. So in that
maybe
case,
an example for California would be the fact that they are essentially a sanctuary state where they're basically telling their state authorities and their municipalities and counties, hey, you are not allowed to contact or report any illegal alien to ICE. Well, that is not in their purview. That is actually listed as part of the authorities in Article 1, Section 8.
Yeah, so that's something else that has to go to the Supreme Court. So what do you do as a citizen? Here's some examples. You can go to your elected officials who you're looking for unelected officials who are defend our unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Support them, yeah, sure, financially, but sometimes call them and say, hey, there's this crazy legislation coming down. What's your opinion on it? And you're holding their feet to the fire and saying, listen, I do or do not support what have you. Or if there's something that you want to encourage your congressman to do ahead of time, believe me, guys, there is so much going on in politics. A congressman cannot cover it all. So when a citizen or a group of citizens comes up and says, hey, this is an issue, that's a message to that representative that this is a significant issue and he or she should pay much attention to it.
Yeah, and that's at all levels too, not even just at the federal branch, your city government, your state government. And the whole point of why Matt and I are discussing with you about why we harped on the Article 1, Section 8, the enumerated powers, and the 10th Amendment is because if you don't know what is in the purview or the authority of the federal government and that versus the state government, then how are you going to hold your elected officials accountable for that or ask them to interpose on your behalf?
That's right. In fact, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, even one example of that, at least verbally, happened just recently, a couple of days ago, after the traitor in chief was inaugurated. And our attorney general here in Texas, he basically said, look, congratulations, President Biden, on your inauguration. However, here in Texas, we stand for our liberties, and we're not going to stand for any encroachment of those liberties by the federal government. So just know that we're going to use every tool in our toolbox to make sure that we oppose any overreaches of power. So now, you know, I'm not always a fan of our officials here in Texas. You know, I think sometimes they're a little bit too weak, but in this case, his rhetoric was good. And so we're just going to hope that his actions when these encroachments happen, I hope that his actions are going to be in line with his rhetoric.
Hope so. So we're going to wrap it up now. So in summary, we're nearing the end of the War of Independence. The Articles of Confederation have failed. Shays' Rebellion was an example of that. We needed a new form of government with the guiding principles of a Republican form of government with checks and balances to ensure that we protected our unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So here's the takeaway, guys. You as a citizen or an elected official can interpose based on the tools the framers gave us in the Constitution to oppose government overreach so we can fully enjoy those unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So great work today, Jason. Folks, thank you very much for joining us today. Please go to patriotcoalitionlive.com for more information. Thank you for your support, especially your monthly support. If you'd like to contribute, go to patriotcoalitionlive.com/support. And remember, we have an email address, freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, like Apple, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It does make a difference. So thank you, everyone. We'll see you here next time.
Take care, gang.